Nothing on this podcast is intended as legal advice, nor does it create an attorney-client relationship. Please be advised that this podcast also contains spoilers and swears. Welcome to Murder, She Woke, a podcast about fashion crimes and actual crimes. I'm your host, Elizabeth.
And I'm your other host, Laura.
So, Laura, welcome back.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
I hear that you accomplished a certain thing in the meantime. Would you like to tell us about it?
Yes, I am a certified pimp. I am a project management professional now.
So can you explain what that means?
It means I paid about $555 to take an exam and I passed the exam. I am qualified to manage projects. So the people that are creating budgets and schedules and scope, I can manage those people.
That sounds really exciting and not at all nerdy and boring as someone who went to law school to get an extra law degree in tax. I understand.
Oh, wait, you have your LLM?
Yeah, I have my LLM in tax.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Congratulations. I had no idea. That's like super nerdy.
Yeah, it was the best 2.5 years and $50,000 of my life.
So. Oh my! Oh my gosh!
I have another couple initials after my name, and I imagine you do too, Esquire, MBA, PIMP. I mean PMP.
Yeah. Oh, and the Lean Six Sigma green belt. Don't forget about that. Oh,
is that like a karate green belt?
It's not. I got my orange belt in karate. Lean Six Sigma is about process improvement and waste management. Not like waste as in like recyclable and garbage, but God, this is a boring podcast. Can we move on?
We're just showing off our credentials here. I can always like intersperse sounds of like explosions and guitar riffs to make it more exciting.
Yeah, no, that was super boring. Sorry to anyone.
No, but you have to finish describing it because I don't know what it is.
Okay, so it's process improvement and waste management. Waste is anything that is not efficient, that creates more time or more processes or is unnecessary to the overall process of what you're doing.
So now that you can do all these things, we will need you to apply that to this podcast because I am not a very good editor because I take forever. And in that vein, we are considering outsourcing that now that we're a runaway success, or not really, I don't know. But I guess just thank you to Jeremy and Rob for the guidance, and hopefully we won't disappoint you and you'll pick us up on a network and we'll be super great and happy and make some money and can retire.
Yes. So if you're out there listening, rate, review, and subscribe. Let's get these numbers up.
In the meantime, I guess until we're famous, we have to keep reviewing Murder, She Wrote. So I guess that's what we're going to have to do.
Well, let's do it.
All that being said, let's talk about season one, episode 11, Death Casts a Spell.
Ooh.
Just kind of a note for all of you, so you don't think that I am bulldozing Laura. It is that we are trying out different formats, and I am going to take the lead on recap, and then she's going to give us her feedback, since I made a lot of notes and I don't know if I'm going to remember everything that happened, but I will try. So So we open on a casino in Lake Tahoe, and there is a sign there for a act, I suppose, called the Amazing Cagliostro. And we know from the description of this episode on Amazon Prime or Peacock, and from the Tonight On, that Mr. Cagliostro, Mr. Amazing, is a hypnotist, and apparently he is quite a big deal. He is in the middle of his act. He's hanging out with his group of people. He's telling them to pretend to be animals, and they're, you know, eating it up, all these well-dressed people, supposedly rich, because Lake Tahoe is for rich people. I don't know. I've never been there.
I bet your rich cousins have.
While all this is happening, we focus on two guys who I have nicknamed Beard and Blondie. Beard is an older guy who's wearing a suit, which is a crime against humanity. And Blondie, I'm assuming, is his protege or kind of his mentee. He is this tall blonde guy. And we learn later that they're both journalists, and they are both like shit talking this Cagliostro guy, talking about how he's a fraud, how he has a secret past, such and such, and blah, blah, blah. And I guess the first question that I asked is, when did hypnotism, or has hypnotism, like this kind of hypnotism, been such a big deal that it necessitated this kind of attention from literally anybody?
So I have kind of a personal experience with hypnotism. I have never been hypnotized. Now, back when I was in college, like the first day of class, every single year, our college would bring in this hypnotist comedian. And like, it was a pretty small school, so everyone just kind of like went to the gym, and this hypnotist would call several people like out on the gym floor and essentially put on a show. And it was hilarious. And it was like one of the best things that the colleges did, like at the student activity board. I also had a professor that was a hypnotist, but I'll talk about that more later. But yes, this guy, you would think, like, with the way they're talking, he should have like a show at Caesar's Palace. One of the scenes that I love, like after he was telling everyone to be animals, I don't know if you caught this, but then he said, okay, now when I snap my fingers, you're going to be naked. And when he snapped his fingers, like everyone was embarrassed and they were like trying to cover themselves up. But there was this one like attractive blonde woman on stage that was very yep. proud of herself. And she was like walking and strutting.
We cut to a hotel room, or what I imagine is a hotel room. And there's a blonde lady who's arguing with her husband. Her name is Regina, but I just call her Blonde Lady. So if you have a better nickname for her, please let me know, because I have no nickname for her.
Sadly, I'm kind of embarrassed to say this, but I just called her Cheating Wife.
Let's call her Regina, because she's not really interesting enough to merit a nickname, in my humble opinion. She's arguing with her husband. His name is Joe. He is the proprietor of this establishment. And they're arguing about the fact that Blonde Lady has been unfaithful to her husband. And her excuse is that Cagliostro hypnotized her into cheating on her husband with him, which I have so many questions about.
I think I can answer probably one of them.
I'm going to let you answer the question Jeopardy style, and then I will let you know.
All right. So if you do not think that hypnotism is real, if you think it's a joke, or if you do not want to be put under, it will not happen. So if you are resisting it, it won't happen.
Given that information, do you think she would have caught on, like maybe after the first tried, because if that's the case, then that becomes salient later. I don't think hypnotism is a hoax. I know people who have been under, I know people have used it to like quit smoking and that kind of thing. I just don't think that it's some sci-fi mind control device like they seem to be using it as in this situation.
Yeah, no, it's definitely not that powerful.
Because it's very weird. They don't set any rules, and I'm not happy about that.
Also, if, let's just say for argument's sake, that hypnotists or hypnotism is this huge mind control thing, don't you think that there would be some kind of code of ethics that hypnotists would have to abide by that prevents this kind of situation?
I would think so. I think this is a huge gaping plot hole that kind of is frustrating to me. But, yes, you know, I guess we have to just go forward assuming that whatever Murder, She Wrote universe there is, that hypnotism is this sci-fi mind control device with no rules of ethics, and that's fine. Regina claims, Blonde Lady claims, that Cagliostro won't let her go, so husband makes a lot of noises about kicking him out of his contract, which is for 3 years and it's for $1 million. And this is like kind of almost not quite a rehash of the plot in Birds of a Feather, but it has that same kind of plot device, the contract with the performer. What we see in the next scene is Joe, husband, he's accosting Cagliostro in the kitchen, and they start shouting about the contracts. Joe tells him to get the hell out. Cagliostro makes some quip about boning his wife. Joe tries to punch him, makes a bunch of threats. And Cagliostro just kind of like saunters off like, fuck you. Maybe we should describe our friend Cagliostro.
To me, Cagliostro looks like Alfred Hitchcock lost 50 pounds. He's old. He's got to be in his 70s, but it's so weird. And maybe he just has some hypnotist like aura about him, but apparently women are just drawn to him. He is a panty dropper.
Big hypnotist energy.
Yes. Yeah. I would say big wand energy, but they don't use wands. Do they?
I mean, he uses his wand, just not on stage.
Rim shot. So he's wearing this outfit. It's white and it seriously looks like a karate outfit. With a karate outfit, you've got like one side that tucks in under the overside, and then you have a belt, and that's kind of like what he's wearing, except his has buttons, and then he's got like these like kind of baggy white pants. What are they, like cotton or linen or something?
Man's got to be comfortable. It's got to breathe, man. I don't know what the climate is like out in Lake Tahoe, but I imagine it gets sweaty up there on that stage with all those people acting like barnyard animals. But is this the same one? This isn't the same outfit he's wearing in the bar, because at some point he wears like an actual legit leisure suit. Like, I had to Google it to make sure I was right, but I was right.
Okay. I'm honestly not even sure what a leisure suit is.
Google it. And I'll keep going, then you can come back and let me know what you think. They get into this fight in the kitchen. Cagliostro just kind of struts off, and we have this picture of Joe as kind of this hothead, and he hates Cagliostro, and the wife is apparently still boning him, or appears to still be, because I guess hypnotism. Like, what does that say about consent?
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. That's a really good point. I mean, so I remember from the experiences I've had with it, the hypnotist on stage or, you know, in the gym was saying you cannot make people do anything they don't want to do or they wouldn't normally do.
That's what Joe says to Regina in the hotel room, too. So that is a well-established rule of the Murder, She Wrote universe.
Yeah. So maybe there's implied consent with that.
The next thing that we see is Jessica. She's checking into her hotel, and she is supposed to be there to meet her editor, Marilyn Dean, But instead of meeting Marilyn Dean, she gets accosted by the world's most annoying assistant editor. I can tell from that groan that you feel the same way about this woman that I do.
I ended up nicknaming her Jesus Joan because every time she did something or said something, I was like, Jesus Joan.
Let's keep that because that's perfect. Because okay. Every time she was on screen, I'm like, literally, what is the stupidest thing you could do? And then make it 10 times stupider. And Joan did it.
She's like a Jack Russell Terrier. She's just like high energy, obnoxious. Sorry if you have a Jack Russell Terrier, anyone out there. I'm sure yours is lovely, just like Wishbone.
Yeah, but the Wishbone ones are, you know, they're probably smarter and more thoughtful than Joan is in these situations, because what has happened is Joan literally lured Jessica, who is a big deal at this point in her publishing company, to Lake Tahoe using the editor's name on a fax.
No. Telegram.
Telegram. Oh, you're right. Telegram.
Because I still don't know what a telegram is. How did Jessica receive? I explained that to you
in an earlier episode. Somebody showed up at her house, probably, or she got it on a little silver platter in her dining room.
Someone showed up at her house. Okay. I still don't really understand telegrams.
I mean, we were negative 3 years old at this point. I don't think that like it matters. But the point is that she got a telegram with Marilyn Dean's name on it saying, come to Lake Tahoe, like right now. And so Jess, who wants to please her editor and their friend, she goes. And instead of getting Marilyn, she gets Joan. Oh my God. Jess is way too nice to her.
Yeah. I would be extremely upset if I got on a plane and went across the country to talk about, I don't know what exactly how she lured her with, you know, what she was talking about, how she got her
phones. Do they know that phones exist?
I don't know. But if I did all of that travel and whatnot under the guise of one thing, and it turns out, oh no, that wasn't a thing. Yeah, we want you to do this instead. I would be very upset. However, I would take that opportunity to exploit, well, I don't know that I would say exploit, but leverage the perks of the relationship. And I would, you know, be getting all of the amenities and whatnot during my stay.
What essentially happens is Joan, who's this assistant editor, has lured Jessica to Lake Tahoe to pitch her on a book idea about Cagliostro, who, for some reason, this woman is straight up obsessed with. I realize it's necessity for a plot device, but I cannot comprehend it. This is like some Alfred Hitchcock wannabe in a leisure suit in some like relative hole in the wall in Lake Tahoe. And this woman is literally risking her job and her career to lie to who is probably a really, really, really big deal at her company, mm-hmm. to get her out there under the, you know, possibility that she might feel the same way.
Jesus Joanne didn't even consider the possibility that Jessica wouldn't like this idea, which that to me is the most outrageous thing. Like, maybe it's because I'm just coming out of studying for the PMP, and a big part of the PMP is analyzing risks and identifying risks. But basically, with this opportunity, Jessica could have said one of two things, yes or no. So how did you not even identify that she would have said no and considered that as an option? Does that make sense?
No, it does.
Okay.
No matter what you're doing, any adult with half a brain would say there's a possibility that this might not work out.
Right.
Like, even when I know like 99% of the time something's going to work out, I still plan for it not working out.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it was just a fail on the part of the casting director, but this guy, Cagliostro, he doesn't have the swagger that I think we are supposed to see and feel.
Because if you remember Silver Fox from like episodes 1 and 2, like he was a handsome, charming guy. So I'm going to get off this topic because it's going to make me mad the more I think about it. Cagliostro is at the bar in the casino in his leisure suit. He's hanging out with his posse, and everybody else in the episode is also in the bar watching him. Regina, she walks in, sits at the bar, like looks over at him, gives him a dirty look, and kind of like huffs off in like 15 seconds. Mm-hmm. And you have Jessica and Joan sitting two tables away. And then you have Blondie and Beard skulking in a back booth. Mr. Beard is the older guy. He is drunk, supposedly, and he accosts Cagliostro and starts yelling about skeletons in his closet and a sketchy ass past and how he's not being transparent and blah, blah, blah. So at this point, we're supposed to know that Beard is kind of an alcoholic. He's like this quintessential alcoholic newspaperman, mm-hmm. like of a certain era, bottle of whiskey in his desk, probably calls the secretary really terrible sexist names and thinks it's a compliment. Uh-huh. And this is another thing that we've seen before, which is the trying to decide if he's acting drunk, if the character is acting drunk, or if the actor is just really bad at pretending to be drunk.
It's like slurring your words, but not really slurring your words.
Yeah, it's trying too hard to slur your words. Because when you're drunk, you don't need any help. Right. And Cagliostro, in a fit of hubris, he tells Beard that he should round up his journalist friends and come to a party in Cagliostro's hotel room, where he's going to spill the beans on his dark and sordid past. But the condition is that Cagliostro is going to hypnotize everybody beforehand, and they're only allowed to print what they remember. Mm-hmm. Joan is eavesdropping on this conversation, of course, and she's getting super excited. In the meantime, Beard tells Blondie that he's drunk AF and that he doesn't want to go up to the room despite making that scene in the bar. He tells Blondie to go to this dubious party in the hotel room instead of him because he wants to go pass out. But Blondie questions him because this is not Beard's first rodeo. He can handle his liquor and he wouldn't give up a scoop like this. But it doesn't matter.
One thing that I do like about this scene is that Beardy, I think that's what you call him. I call him Bearded Bud. Bud's his name. But Beardy is kind of calling his Cagliostro's bluff a little bit, like saying, and then Cagliostro doubled down and he's like, okay, well, if you think that, you know, let's do a tradesy. I'll tell you anything you want to know under the condition that I get to hypnotize you first. So I thought that was a pretty smart move in the Murder, She Wrote world where hypnotism works the way they are portraying.
We suspend the laws of like physics and psychology and accept this Murder, She Wrote universe rules. This is a pretty juicy setup. And Joan figures this out. So what she does is she ambushes Cagliostro outside his hotel room, name drops Jessica, and then invites herself and Jessica to the party in his hotel room. She has not asked Jess, as far as I know, mm-hmm. and has decided that she has a streak of good luck with doing the whole shoot first, ask questions later approach. We go back to the casino, the bar casino area. Blondie is introducing himself to Jess. Jess tells him that she knows that Beard is faking drunk and she kind of wants to know why. He doesn't know why Beard is doing what he's doing. And he hypothesizes that Beard is just trying to give him a scoop because he's young and he's still trying to make it in the business. So he goes to the elevator. And in the meantime, Jess is walking out of the casino and she gets ambushed by, I'm going to use two references here, and you can take whichever one you want, because I have a feeling only one is going to land and you're going to make fun of me for the other one.
Okay.
Either Mimi from the Drew Carey Show.
Okay. A slim version. Sure.
Yes. Or Lwaxana Troi from Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Why would you even think I would get that reference?
That's why I gave you two, and I told you, I to be fair, I did warn you. Yeah. So I feel like that gets me off the hook. She thinks that Jessica is a soap opera star, and she starts bothering her about it. And when Jess insists that, no, I'm not a soap opera person, Lwaxana says, oh, it's just our secret. And Jess is yelling to Blondie, who's over by the elevator, like, help, like, get me away from this crazy lady. He doesn't turn around, and she is still trying to get rid of this nut job. And nut job just so happens to have a J.B. Fletcher in her purse. And Jess is like, no, this is me. And she points to the picture like, yeah. And then this lady says, you know, it's not you, and storms off.
Yeah, she gets really mad about it.
Here comes Joan again. And Jesus Christ, Joan.
Jesus, Joan.
She is so excited because she got them into the party in Cagliostro's room. And she convinces Jess to go, but they are too late. We see a bunch of people who are the press, in quotation marks, and they all sit in a semicircle, and he starts hypnotizing the press, and then he starts telling a story. Jess and Joan are late, and there is a man who I think we might have seen before. He's just kind of one of Joe's goons, and I nicknamed him Mustache because that's his only distinguishing feature. He's this tall guy with a very prominent mustache.
So when Cagliostro and the hotel owner got in a fight in that hallway, he was there, and he was also in the restaurant.
He can't let them in because he doesn't have the key. And all of a sudden, there's this crash and the door is locked so they can't get in. But then out of the elevator, here comes Joe, who I guess has a skeleton key or like a master key to every room. He opens up the door. They burst in. Cagliostro is stabbed dead on the floor, and the press people are still standing there staring into the, you know, middle distance with their mouths open. They're still out to lunch, apparently still hypnotized. We're kind of left with a dun dun dun, and what we see after that is the police are in the room, and there is a police, I assume he's a detective. I nicknamed him Lieutenant Pipe because he was smoking like a legit pipe.
Yes, he was. I loved that guy.
He doesn't understand what's going on with the press, and he doesn't know how to unhypnotize them because they're still staring into space. Jessica suggests that they take Joan's recording of Cagliostro's show from an earlier night and use that to unhypnotize them. It works. They awake and they are straight up not having a good time. Apparently, nobody remembers a single thing. And this is a problem because we're in this weird situation where a murder has taken place in front of half a dozen witnesses and nobody can remember anything. And these are members of the press. So this is something that they would be uniquely suited to in terms of being able to give descriptions, etc. So it's extra ironic. After that, we see Jessica, who's jogging on what appears to be a golf course, and she's wearing our favorite blue tracksuit.
Yes, with the red and white stripes and her white ascot.
I love that tracksuit. But here's fucking Joan again.
Jesus, Joan.
this whole episode is just people confronting and accosting one another. Like, that is the entire plot thing. It's always people. I realize that happens when you're going to have like character driven versus, you know, if it's like a World War II movie where you're just looking at a bunch of tanks. Mm-hmm. But this just seems like this whole episode just seems weirdly unnatural, the way people are confronting each other.
There's a lot of blocking going on.
It doesn't look like it happens naturally. Mm-hmm. They're just all coming up to each other out of the blue, yelling something, and then walking away.
Like, so many of my notes start with like, and then so-and-so walks up, and then so-and-so walks up.
I use the word confront and accost and ambush, and I like ran out of words to and I'm like, oh, this is gonna, you know, try the fabric of my liberal arts education.
Wow, I think we might need to unpack this verbiage usage a little bit later on in the episode, because you seem a little angry.
I am angry because I had to think of new words while I was watching this. I was very stressed out because I didn't want people to think I wasn't smart enough to come up with new words. Jessica tells Joan that Lieutenant Pipe has told her she was free to go, but she thinks she's going to stick around and help solve the mystery. So that's the whole scene, is just saying, it's unbelievable, I'm going to stick around, but just till tomorrow. That's fine. The next scene is Jess in the office with a psychologist, Dr. Yambert, who actually, we first saw him in the first scene with Lieutenant Pipe. He was he works with hypnotism too. So he was trying to get them out of the trance. Mm-hmm. But Dr. Yambert appears to enjoy appropriating African culture.
Yeah, I'm glad you noticed that too. It's like wooden masks, and like I don't really know how to describe
it. What a white person thinks that African stuff looks like.
Yes, when in all likelihood he bought this from the airport like gift shop.
Exactly. And he probably tells people that like a chief in a far-flung tribe gave it to him because he proved himself as some kind of, you know, trustworthy or some kind of great warrior. You could bet, I guarantee you, he tells people that.
I kind of like this guy. He was kind of funny. I like this scene. I like this whole scene.
I like him too. And I guess back in the 80s, appropriating cultures was not as frowned upon as it is these days. If you did it today, it would be a red flag for, this guy is bad and dumb.
Yeah.
But for him, it's just like, oh, look at this guy who is cultured and has lots of things from around the world.
Yes.
Also, when did Rorschach tests go out of style?
Did they?
I'm asking you, because he has all those ink prints behind him.
I didn't notice those. I mean, okay, so are they really legitimate?
I don't know.
I don't either.
I suppose it's not so much that they tell about a person, is they kind of start a conversation and give you insight into people's mind. Like, I don't think that they're
used for analytical purposes, but I mean, maybe obviously a little bit, that's the purpose, but it's not going to evaluate a subject completely. Like, I kind of think like maybe it's the same as like word association games.
That's how I saw it. And as somebody who's been in therapy for a long time and will probably be there for more time, I've never had an inkblot test. So
no, me neither.
Yeah,
we did have long discussions and sessions about the Myers-Briggs tests and, you know, how that affects me. And
I've never taken that, so I don't know what I am.
I am an ISO something J, ISTJ, ISTJ.
Okay. But so what does that mean about you?
I is introvert, T is thinking as opposed to feeling. So we make decisions based off of analyzing the situation instead of just like how we feel about it. And then J is judging. Maybe that's, you know, Jesus, I don't know. Basically, I'm an introvert. I analyze situations. I rely on data and historical information. I don't just go with my gut.
Got it. Okay. That comports as a person who I believe knows you well enough to make a judgment. I agree. He wants to prove to her that hypnotism is in fact legit. He starts to hypnotize her and she just acts like nothing happened. But it turns out that she was hypnotized. He made her say a bunch of funny stuff. She pretended to be a barfly and then a rich person. Jessica, as a hypnotized rich lady, told Dr. Yambert that his office sucked and that the decor was crappy. And I had to agree with her.
Yeah.
Woke Jessica, 2021 Jessica, would be like, why are you appropriating African culture for your office? It doesn't look good. We get a scene where Mustache bursts into Regina's room and says that they have to discuss money after what happened last night, presumably Cagliostro's murder. I guess this is an attempt to add subterfuge or like an additional layer to the plot, but it honestly feels like to me kind of abrupt and a little jerky. It reminds me of the Seattle episode where we just kept getting like random ass things thrown in there that didn't really seem to make sense with one another.
Yes, this kind of was like a non sequitur, but not really, but kind of.
Yeah. We go back to the casino. Blondie is playing the slots and Jessica starts asking him questions about what happened in the room while he was hypnotized. He said he doesn't know. This is where he uses the word or the term lift for elevator, as all British people do. So apparently this is supposed to set off alarm bells.
Honestly, I heard this. I heard like him say lift and I was like, oh, that sounds weird. And then I just figured it was like one of those British things that just like worked its way into the, you know, screenwriting somehow, like under suspicion of murder and coroner's inquest, which, by the way, friend of the pod, Katie, says that a coroner's inquest is a real thing.
We go back to the crime scene where it looks like the police are destroying the room. And yeah. They don't really say why, but I assume it's because they're trying to figure out how somebody could get into a locked room. And they don't appear to have found anything. She starts kissing Lieutenant Pipe's ass. He thinks that it might be Joe, but there are too many logistical issues that Jess points out. The fact that Joe burst out of the elevator like right after the crash, and they're basically eliminated him as a suspect. The next scene is Beard telling Blondie to stop talking to Jess. That's it. That's the whole scene.
Yes.
We see the blue tracksuit again when Jessica is following another lead, which is Kelly Upster's assistant, Sherry. Sherry is in what I can only describe as a tetanus gym because literally every piece of equipment is just metal. It reminds me of the Seattle episode where you have that weird treadmill that he was on that was all metal with the two settings. So just think of that, but like a whole gym. Kelly Upster's assistant, Sherry, like she's a blonde lady, and she basically spills the beans on literally everything. She explains the relationship between Beard and Cagliostro, and what it had happened is that Beard was a reporter in London or England. Apparently, Cagliostro hypnotized Beard into printing lies about him and then sued him for libel, got him fired, and got his bureau chief fired.
So I don't think she actually ever said the word hypnotized. She did say the word tricked. So okay. Cagliostro tricked Bearded Bud into printing these lies. But should we unpack that now?
Libel is printing a lie, a false statement about somebody. Slander is whenever you say it out loud to a third party. Libel is whenever you put it in writing. Mm-hmm. This can be anything from a text message to a newspaper headline to a Super Bowl blimp. I don't know how this works in England because this is where this took place. They have different rules, but in America, there's a whole sliding scale over what level of knowledge slash intent you had to have to be found liable for libel, depending on who the person you're libeling mm-hmm. is. If I were to go on the internet and say, Donald Trump picks his nose and eats his boogers, that wouldn't be the same as me saying, Laura of Atlanta, Georgia, steals gummy bears from the local CVS. There's a difference because Laura's not a public figure, whereas Donald Trump is. And then there's also a whole sliding scale with damages. There are some damages where you have to prove that you were damaged. Other ones you just get automatically based on what kind of things they're saying about you. It's a whole festival of fun.
Yeah, there's a bunch of, like you said, sliding scales. Biggest thing that I remember from law school is like the scrutiny levels as far as like the public officials. And then you've mm-hmm. got, I can't remember what the intermediate was,
like, but it
was
limited like, public figures.
Okay.
It would be somebody like Monica Lewinsky during that period. Now she's just kind of a public figure, but somebody but who is only like a public figure in a certain context.
Right. And then there's like, what is it? Is it called private? Private?
Yeah. I think it's just the private person, like Joe Schmo living his own life and not bothering anybody.
And so basically, if you are saying or printing someone about a public official like the president or Madonna or a household name, the person that is speaking or printing has a lot more protections as far as what they can say or write, as opposed to the private person.
And the theory behind that is that because a public official has inserted themselves into the public consciousness, that they've given up a certain amount of privacy and rights by being public officials. Mm-hmm. So that's why you see tabloids and why tabloids can get away with these ridiculous things. Whereas it would be different if, let's say, one of my coworkers called a local newspaper and said that I steal gummy bears from the local CVS. Mm-hmm. Fun story though. When I was in law school, in my 1L year, the second semester when we were learning about this in torts, I was actually, while this was happening, being libeled by a former friend that I had gone to college Uh-oh. With. Such well, that my torts professor actually wrote a letter to Facebook.
Shut up. No way. You got a professor to like act as legal counsel on your behalf?
Well, no, she basically sent an email saying, why are you letting this guy libel my student on Facebook? He basically said a bunch of stuff, that I was a big slut and I slept with like hundreds of guys and that I had STDs.
That's like one of the things where you don't really have to prove damages.
Yeah, I didn't even have to prove damages. And it was in Florida. Apparently accusing a woman of being not virtuous is like a misdemeanor in Florida. So
what happened?
Well, he took down all the stuff, but nothing damage really was done happened after that. Yeah, he was in Miami while I was up north. And so like he wasn't far from me. And then like mutual friends of ours were like, yeah, this guy is like saying stuff about you on Facebook that's pretty bad.
Oh, gosh.
And so the difference between calling me a slut and saying I have STDs is that slut is an opinion, whereas mm-hmm. STDs is a fact. So if he says, you know, Elizabeth so-and-so has gonorrhea, I can prove or disprove that factually, whereas slut is a matter of opinion.
As far as proving someone has slandered or libeled you, one element is that what they said or wrote, A, has to be false, and B, the person speaking or writing knew it to be false.
The truth is always a defense. And then the idea that if I say something about you that I think is true and I have genuine cause to believe it's true, that is a defense. It may not work, but it is a defense.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for joining us for Libel Talk. Just a side note, what comes out of this conversation is that Sherry used to be a trapeze artist / stripper. And she had this whole act where I guess she was stripping while on a trapeze. So that becomes salient later at some mm-hmm. point, or it becomes a plot point later. Sherry admits to that to Jessica in the scene, which makes the next scene really weird because Joan is eavesdropping on Blondie, who's talking on a payphone. And all we learn from that scene is Sherry used to be a stripper on a trapeze.
Yeah.
We literally just learned that.
So I think the whole purpose of the scene was to show that now Jesus Joan now knows that information and she's going to do a very Joan thing.
Ugh. And the next scene is Joe, not to be confused with Joan, yelling about how guests are leaving early because someone was murdered in the hotel and apparently murder is bad for business. So that's happening too. After that, we see Jessica confronting Beard, who is sunbathing in a three-piece suit.
I love this guy.
And she asks him why he was pretending to be drunk. And
okay, hold on. Back up. First, yes. He offers her a snort.
I heard that, and I wasn't sure if I was mishearing that.
I replayed it and put on closed captions. He did say care for a snort. I did Google it. That can also mean like a shot of whiskey or a drink of whiskey.
Do you think it was like purposefully ambiguous?
Oh God. Well, no, I don't know. Stripper.
That guy does coke. If anybody does coke, it's him.
Oh, he definitely does coke.
A newspaper guy in the 80s. Oh, fuck yeah, he does coke.
And another thing that I love about him is that instead of calling the waitress over, he calls her nurse. I loved that.
Yeah, and then he chucks her out as she walks away.
Yeah, I'm really surprised he didn't pat her on the ass as she walked away.
Well, there was a lady present, so he had to mind his manners. While they're having this conversation, Jess confronts him. He says that he didn't go because he thought that whole thing was bullshit and he wanted to get out of it. And that's why he sent the kid. And then they look up and they see on the side of the hotel, somebody's like on a harness, like rope situation on the side of the building.
It's called rappelling.
Rappelling. So they decide that they're going to go up and investigate.
So Joan has put this whole scheme together where I think she's probably called the lieutenant and told the lieutenant that she thinks that Sherry Diamond is the murderer. Meanwhile, on the roof, there's like several policemen and they are using this huge mechanical platform contraption to help this guy rappel off the roof. But Joan has it in her big hair brain that Sherry Diamond was able to pull off this murder by herself by swinging from the roof to the balcony and then killing Cagliostro and then swinging either back up onto the roof or rappelling down the building. No. It was that she jumped onto the balcony below and I guess entered in the building that way.
So she's basically Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible in this.
Yes. Right. But it becomes clear that when Joan kind of implies this and nudges Sherry Diamond to the edge of the building, Sherry Diamond gets visibly upset and anxious and nervous. and elbows her way out. And it's pretty apparent that Sherry Donovan does not enjoy the heights.
This is something that Joan apparently does not notice, but Jessica does. So we're going to kind of put that in our back pocket for a little bit later. What we see in the next scene is Joe, who's still pissed off at losing all this business. And he yells at Lieutenant Pike to basically get a move on and figure this thing out. Jess takes this opportunity to accuse him, saying that, well, I guess maybe not even accusing him, but trying to feel out kind of what his deal is. Mm-hmm. She says, this guy was boinking your wife and you had him in this contract. And he says that his lawyers found a way to get out of it. A morals clause. I know some clauses in like endorsement contracts have it, like with sports and stuff. Mm-hmm. If the person does anything to damage the brand, then that'll like nullify the contract.
Yeah.
Like if LeBron James went out and killed someone, like Nike would be like, no. That's what I assume. Assuming he has a deal with Nike, and I think everybody does. And also that it's not libel because I am not accusing LeBron James of murder. And Jess and Joan are talking about it, and they come to the conclusion that those inside didn't have motives and the ones with motives couldn't get in. So they're all in a pickle. In the meantime, we see Jess, who spots Regina, who is sneaking out of the hotel wearing a crushed velvet jacket and matching hat.
I thought that she put like a scarf over her head and big sunglasses. But either way, she was trying to be inconspicuous. So sketchy.
If she just walked out of there and walked into her car like a normal person, nobody would have noticed anything.
Right.
The whole like, you know, eyes darting around.
Yes.
So Jess wants to follow her. And she talks to this young man, and she ends up climbing on the back of his motorcycle and doing like this low speed car chase to a random spot where Regina gets out of the car and hands Mustache a bunch of money. Mm-hmm. So this leads us to the next scene where Jess ambushes Regina and accuses her. Turns out Mustache is blackmailing her because she had offered Mustache money to kill Cagliostro, but he taped it and then blackmailed her with it. We go to the set of Twin Peaks, where Jess, Lieutenant Pike, and Joan are all sitting around talking it through. And Joan still thinks it's Sherry. Lieutenant Pike doesn't have any idea. And he puts out the line where he says,
I've got 6 witnesses, 5 suspects, 1 very dead body, and no case. 6 competent, intelligent, observant newsmen and women actually witness a murder and can't tell me a thing. They might as well be deaf, dumb, and blind.
And all of a sudden, we get that Jay Fletch aha moment.
Mm-hmm.
So this leads us to a scene at the bar where Joan is talking to Beard.
Jesus, Joan
is talking to Beard, and she is feeding him information. So she's finally being useful after an entire episode of creating chaos. And she tells him that they suspect Sherry because of her trapeze situation, and that Jess is maybe going to write a book about it, and don't print anything until it becomes public knowledge. And all of a sudden, we see Lieutenant Pike in the next scene, who's pestering Blondie, and they had the idea that they could rehypnotize him, and maybe he would be able to remember what was going on under hypnosis. So this guy walks in, and he's supposedly a hypnotist or a doctor, who knows, and we see this quintessential 80s flashback where you see the screen kind of like, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like go wavy.
Yeah.
And then we see the scene where Sherry, as Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible, breaks in through the sliding glass door, kills Cagliostro and sneaks out. All of a sudden, after he wakes up from the second hypnotism, he recalls all this stuff. So Blondie insists that Sherry Diamond was the killer. Jessica tells him he's full of crap because this is almost verbatim what Joan told Beard at the bar. And it turns out that this hypnotist is a blackjack dealer from a casino across the way. And they were faking it to trick Blondie into making a mistake. So as it turns out, Blondie had earplugs in and he was never actually initially hypnotized, even though he pretended to be, which is why he did not hear Jessica at the elevator or yell at him while he was at the elevator. And she makes the connection that he spent time in England, and then he does the fucking thing that everybody does, which is fucking confess.
Literally, there was no evidence. Like, the fact that he called an elevator a lift and that he purchased earplugs from the gift shop, that is a weak ass case.
It turns out that Blondie's dad was Beard's bureau chief in England. And when Cagliostro sued him and Beard for libel, he lost his job and then killed himself. So Blondie, this was his revenge. So that's the big reveal. So I guess, hooray. The button on the episode is Lieutenant Pike kissing Jess's ass saying, you know, if I need another mystery solved, I'll call you. And then Jess is like sneaking away and she almost makes it. And then fucking Jesus Joan just shows up again. And they talk about writing the book. Joan says, oh, well, they want a chancy ending, so it's Sherry. And this leads just with a what? And that's the end of the episode. So.
Oh.
Jesus.
Jesus. Joan. Okay. So, Elizabeth, how do you feel about this episode? What are your likes or dislikes? And what's your rating?
I gave it 4 ashtrays out of 10.
Oh, wow.
Mostly because I got frustrated that the same thing kept happening over and over again. And I ran out of words to describe what was happening because I don't like using the same words over and over again. I didn't like the mustache subplot. I really disliked Joan, and I didn't find Cagliostro like sympathetic as a victim.
Wow, that's got to be like one of the worst ratings you've given so far.
Yeah, but I was also like kind of in a crabby mood when I watched it, so I feel like maybe I wasn't entirely fair.
Okay.
And so, okay, let's give it 4.5 ashtrays.
Oh, okay. All right.
To build in the crabby curve. How about you? How do you feel about this episode?
I didn't dislike it nearly as much. I would give it 6.5 ashtrays. I thought it was entertaining. I liked the whole hypnotist kind of feel to it. You know, I have fond memories of hypnotists in college, and I have to give a shout out to one of my sorority sisters, Emily. One of our professors in college was actually a hypnotist, and during class, he hypnotized us, and my good friend Emily played Wipeout on her butt cheeks. That is something I will never forget. I thought the episode was okay. I thought like they didn't give you enough for you to figure out who the killer was. And that irritates me when there's just no way you could have reasonably thought through and picked up on any clues, because there were very little clues. I don't like that. So 6.5 ashtrays.
Well, just really quickly, Golden Grady, question mark?
I think that we should probably say it at the same time on the count of 3.
Okay. 1, 2, 3.
Jesus, yeah. Joan. Wait, you didn't pick Joan?
I didn't pick Joan. I picked Beard because he seemed like, it seemed like Grady in the future if left unchecked.
Oh, no. I mean, Joan has just tripped over herself this entire way and somehow convinced Jessica to write a book that she didn't even want to write to begin with, and then changed the ending.
Yeah, she does have big, gritty energy. I think I agree with you, and I would like to retract my earlier statement. I was looking forward instead of focusing on the present, which
that's fine.
I'm going to do a quick talk about next week, and then we can finally let you guys go. This is season one, episode 12, Capital Offense.
Ooh, I like the double entendre.
Ooh la la. When a congressman suddenly dies from a heart attack, Jessica is asked to temporarily replace him in Washington. It's Mrs. Fletcher Goes to Washington.
Yes. Yay. Yes.
Okay, so we have that to look forward to. And in the meantime, thanks to everybody who listens, rate, review, subscribe. Thanks to Jeremy and other people that are pod adjacent who know things. And thank you, Laura, for joining me on this adventure.
You're quite welcome, Elizabeth.
Well, goodbye for now. And remember, stay woke.
Stay woke. Yeah.